Welcome to the Aviator Zone Podcast. Aviator Zone Podcast. With your host, Captain Felipe Santiago. Flying stories, career advice, and a lot of hangar talk. Let's talk aviation.
Welcome back. Today we have a guest I've been trying to interview for a very long time. We're going to do this episode originally in Oshkosh last year, but we got way too busy. One of the best aviation photographers on Instagram, an adventure pilot, Dion Mitten. Dion, welcome to the show. We also have with us today my co-pilot for this trip, Tristan Sivas. Tristan, welcome. Shooting this episode all the way from Newark, guys. Let's get started. Welcome to the show.
Same place, same time, you know. We just all got into New York.
We've been talking already for probably about 4 hours before this podcast, so that's why we decided to bring my first officer on board, who happens to also be an old student of Aviator Zone Academy. He did get his multi with us a while back. So, guys, thanks for coming. Thanks for taking the time to do this.
Of course.
We were talking about computers, and I think a way to connect this with aviation is that recent video that I released about the Apple Vision Pro. A lot of people don't know, but your background really comes with IT, right? So tell us a little bit about yourself. What got you into flying? How did you transition from the IT? What made that transition and how you got into
I'm already on a different time zone. I'm 8 hours ahead, so I'm very, very sleepy. So if this doesn't come across well, then just, you know how to edit. I started flying when I just graduated college because I was always curious to fly. And so I got my PP. I saved up a bunch of money. I worked for 10 years to save up money to pay for the PPL. And then fast forward, I built a career in technology, in high tech. It happened to take me into online, the world of online, internet, online stuff. And finally, I got to a point where I really wanted to do more flying. And as corporate goes in the US, there's very little time to do leisure things. So I decided that I'll quit the technology industry and fly full time.
So I know, and just so that the audience knows, at this time, were you in the United States or were you outside of the U.S.? Where were you?
Yeah, so originally I started flying in Africa. I did my initial training there, PPL, and flew around for 10 years and then came to the U.S. I've been in the U.S. now for 30 years and 20 of that in corporate technology, high tech, like the West Coast high tech stuff. And then when I started my professional aviation training, I did that for the most part in California.
Got it. Yeah. So the reason why I wanted that backstory too is fast forward now we were just talking about data centers, how the internet works and technology. What do you think of this whole AI stuff that we've been talking a lot about? Like we were kind of just moving into that conversation. So do you think that that's going to affect us as pilots and jobs? Do you think that it's going to make our lives easier or is it going to replace us in the cockpit at one point and say, you know, you're going to be sitting in a computer somewhere monitoring an airplane? What do you feel? I mean, you have more background on that. You really understand this technology. Do you think that it's going to change the world, the way that we fly airplanes and what the future holds for aviation?
So I think there's many dimensions if you consider the entire ecosystem of what you're describing. First of all, the term AI the way that it's being used right now is a little bit misunderstood, I think, by the general public just because it's sensationalized. And artificial intelligence, the true scientific basis of that is formulated on the science and the technology that makes machines, that equips machines with the ability to reason and to learn, to acquire knowledge. What we see today is not really that. The internet and the data behind it up to now has been just a big collection of interesting data, Wikipedia and data of all sorts. What the commercial companies have done is if you can think of the typical search engine interface, it's a text-based search engine. Sometimes you could dictate, but for the most part, it's textual-based and you can enter a keyword search and Google would render the results. It'll go back and search the data set. Well, they've just enhanced that and said, well, what if we can put a natural language interface to that? So you can speak in your own language. And you can get the response in a conversational style. Hence, the model of large language models, LLMs, is the foundation of the technology the way that it's implemented right now. So what we're consuming or what we're presented with as AI is just the same data with a different interface and conversational style interface. Large language model just refers to the fact that natural languages can be used to interact and acquire or request or either store or query the data. So we're seeing the same data that's been available all over this time. When the term model gets used, the model is essentially a reference to a big data set. So let's say you say the Wikipedia repository of data. Well, what if I put an English language interpreter in front of it and I can actually speak to this Wikipedia? That's really what's going on today. And so the high-tech companies, Google, all of the FAANG companies, Facebook, Amazon, they've built these models, they've engineered it in a way that we can either store or acquire information via a language interpreter. Hence the ChatGPT interfaces where you can type in your language of choice, tell me the story and tell it to me in this style, and you're getting presented with the data that's really stored already just in a natural language format. There is very little learning on the machine side acquiring new knowledge. It's not doing that yet. Is it possible? Yes, it is, but not in the way my SP presented today.
My understanding of this is, you know, I guess, and again, part of my ignorance on this field, but AI to me is something that a computer that can make a decision on its own based on its learning from observing and reading and looking on databases, and which is the same way that we learn,
yeah,
right?
Yep, yep.
You know, how do I become a pilot? I became a pilot because my instructor taught me that this is how you do it. So they're putting inputs into me. I'm storing those inputs and I'm replicating them in the future.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is we really don't have anything that much newer than just rewriting and putting it.
Not in what's presented. It does exist, but not in the way that it's presented via the ChatGPT or the interfaces that are being put out there today. If you look at the science of how we're trying to build machines that can learn like humans learn, there are various fields of academic study. For example, neural networks. Scientists have figured out how the brain connects and how we're forming how our brain function works. And they're trying to simulate that with machines. And there's, for example, a sub-study called neural nets. Neural nets is the science of trying to mathematically model what the brain is doing and then building a machine to recreate that. If you could successfully do that, you could argue that, well, if it's a brain, it can learn like a learning brain. So you could give it stimulus of very basic form and, let's say, an environment, and it can acquire, it can figure out its own ways, can make its own decisions, and get to acquire more knowledge than initially was seeded into the system.
Okay.
That's a learning system. Yeah, well, it could think, it could make decisions, but it could also make interpretations of the initial data set. Now, there are models today. Of course, the science doesn't stand still, and there are techniques for building such systems. There are also techniques for training such systems. For example, I'll throw out one. A very interesting learning technique is adversarial networks. It's essentially where you have a machine, two machines of similar type and similar definition, and you pitch them against each other. You have them talk to each other. You don't tell them what the problem is, but you just seed it with some data. And then they start challenging each other, and so they start making interpretations based on the challenge and the responses. And the scientists have figured out that you can use that technique, and I'm speaking very conceptually, for machines to learn really very rapidly, almost, you can argue, at the speed of light. So there's techniques that you could make machines learn and acquire knowledge. So back to the question, do humans have a role? Of course, humans have a role. In aviation specifically, there's also the other part of governance and regulation for the purpose of safety.
There's a caravan operator right now that's using
autonomous
to fly these caravans. What do you think about that? I mean, you were a caravan pilot.
They're demonstrating an autonomous flight system. Autonomous systems have been around for a long time, like SpaceX is using autonomous guidance systems, missile guidance systems, tactical systems that can interpret and use dynamic data sets as the environment changes to update itself and make decisions on. So you can think in the aviation, you can think of the INS, for example. It's kind of a very basic machine system, the inertial navigation system that gets seeded with a location, then uses a set of gyroscopes and accelerometers to detect acceleration and velocity in a certain direction. And over time, you could say, well, I started here and I was autonomous for a period of time and I know where I am right now.
Right.
Take the same model. And so what the caravan, that operator is doing is using an existing available technology, which is autopilot for operating the machine and providing it with contextual data and probably a flight path. I don't know that it's making decisions other than just is flying a pre-programmed
route.
Flight path.
And I think that's the biggest challenge. You know, we're pilots, right? We've been in the cockpit on a daily basis and we understand the amount of decision-making that happens from a flight from the point that you take off. I mean, how many decisions did we make today? Like, it was constant, right? Like, do we put the flaps down now? Do we wait here? Do we turn now? Do we accelerate? You know, is a computer ready to do that? And are they, is it already programmed to do that? And is it going to be as good as somebody else? Like, how does a computer determine, like, okay, we had an engine failure and we're going to, you know, this airplane needs to crash land somewhere. Am I going to land on a school, or I'm going to go on in the forest? Or there's so many variables. Like,
well, yeah, and look at the analogy of what's going on in the self-driving vehicle domain. It's one of the big challenges is to be autonomous, deterministic in the outcome or the predictability of the outcome of that machine that'll make the correct decision. What is correct? Is it ethically correct, morally correct? Is it factually just, is it a numbers game, you know,
right,
risk reward? Well, there are so many factors. You can make a machine do things autonomously, but for the tough decisions, unless you provide the correct and sufficient amount of data for it to make a really tough decision, I don't think that we're there yet.
Who do you hold accountable when that machine makes a decision? Like the guy that programmed it?
Right. Back to what are the rules that society governs the correct and morally and ethically correct or acceptable set of values? Like, if damage is the only outcome of the decision that has to be made at a certain point in time, how do we determine more or less damage? What are the rules by which we determine? So let's say, you could argue, is it monetary damage? Is it damage of life? Do we preserve property over life, over human? What about animal kingdom life? All of those things. It's just
a lot of variables.
Too many variables in a dynamically changing situation. The self-driving vehicle thing is struggling with exactly that problem. If you elevate that to a three-dimensional space and apply it to aviation, the same kind of principles hold true. I mean, it's a very complex problem. And
I guess
not just
more complex.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot more variables. You know, how do you show a computer how to, you know, read weather and determine which way is the best route to take for this scenario? You know,
yeah.
How do you program that?
Well, how do you program that? How do you validate and prove that it will make the correct decision if given the, you know, these corner cases? So you could argue that in a simulation environment, we could generate all the permutations of possible scenarios. Let's say you could arguably do that. We have to evaluate that the correct decisions by some measure were taken. And in the sciences, there's in simulation, like flight simulators, for example, the problem solving there is kind of the same thing. You have to figure out that flight control system will operate within the limits of normal, will remain in the limits of normal operation, whether that's dampening a flight control or avoiding oscillation, you know, those kind of typical flight dynamics.
If you were to put a timeline, how soon, like, would you think that we would have this technology really available for us?
Like autonomous aircraft?
Mm-hmm.
Well, experimentally,
yeah, we're going to see it in our timeline. Do you think that we're going to
like operating it in a large commercial application?
Right.
Like, for example, an airline flies by itself with humans not primarily controlling. I think we might get to a small scale. I think we might get to, you know, like with everything, when you want to be risk averse, you take small baby steps and you'll try and mitigate or minimize risk by a phased approach so that humans can observe and intervene and correct.
Right? With cargo first.
Yeah, I agree. I think it would start with, you know, smaller, like the caravans, right? And then move into maybe cargo and then future passengers. But I don't think that we're going to see it. I don't know. I feel maybe it's just wishful thinking, but I don't think it's going to be in our lifetime. I think we'll probably go down to one pilot in the airlines.
Well, part of the big risk equation is not so much can the platform operate autonomously. It's the potential risk or the quantifying the potential risk when catastrophic failure happens. So when you're thinking of airborne objects, the collateral damage potentially is the life and property on the ground.
Pilots are a lot cheaper.
Well, and it's also the damage on the ground. So you would have to be really, I don't know that that's possible, because you'd have to have an inventory of the exact potential damage covering all of Earth. Of if things go wrong, what is the mid-air breakup? What is the potential collateral damage on the ground when things go wrong up there? And I don't think we'll be in a place where society will okay
a computer that risk.
Yeah, we're seeing the leading edge of that, exploring, you know, the parcel delivery with unmanned, you know, aerial devices dropping a parcel. And so in rural areas, it might be acceptable because, you know, there's very little population density. There's actually some experiments in developing countries where they're moving medical supplies.
With drones. DJI is doing that.
Well, and there's a few examples around the world where they're doing it very successfully, but they're flying over rural area with near zero or little known population. So where society can okay and say, yeah, it's life preserving. And we will take we'll accept the risk of damaging people and property on on ground.
Now, but you know, I didn't notice, but when we talk with Dion about technology, he gets really, really excited. Like we were, your eyes just was like, you were so happy. Like we were just talking about these data centers. I can just tell like how the excitement there about this technology.
Mm, it's very boring stuff.
It's boring stuff, but it's very interesting.
It's fascinating science for sure.
Yeah.
That it is. Yeah. Like how do the binary system work? How do computers work with zeros and ones and all of that stuff? Yeah. It's fascinating. The science and how the bright-minded people in generations before us figured out stuff. And we talked about electricity, how they evolved and how we have harnessed electromagnetic energy so we can communicate with.
But I tell you what, you also get excited when we talk about adventure flying and seaplane flying. And I think that's where you're passionate. That's how really we met. You know, I think we met on Instagram and then we met down at the seaplane base in Miami. So how did you get involved like in aviation, in adventure flying, really? Because that's what I call that kind of flying. I think a lot of people want to experience that or be part of that. And there's really not a lot of guidance on how to get there. Tell me a little bit about that. How did you get into that and how did you push it forward?
I would say, and we talked about this, I was very blessed growing up to have parents that have instilled a sense of curiosity and adventurous spirit in me. As a child, we would always be out. We would be picnicking in the outdoors and we'd be made curious about what's on the other side of the little mountain top or the hill or around the corner. So I think curiosity has driven me to explore a few of the more remote places in North America and Europe and such. And where I ran into some fascinating lifestyles, and I was fortunate enough to observe how people and cultures operate there. And so specifically the seaplane or the floatplane flying, I would say mostly inspired by what I found in Alaska when I first started traveling there. And you know, everything that is Alaska and the challenge of operating in an off airport, off grid environment with the elements, the environmental elements and terrain as challenges all the time. And so it occurred to me that people have figured out ways to operate aviation despite all these challenges, and they still get to do it. And it's a fairly adventurous kind of a lifestyle, which appealed to me. And I was curious of what that would be like. So I started strategizing to get outside of my corporate office and get into the outdoors. And I envisioned a lifestyle that would include a palm tree and Caribbean waters and a float plane. And I just,
so made the plan. And you picked up the phone and you called an operator? Like, how did you?
No, I figured out a plan. And I think this is what people would tell you when you ask them about how they got from point A to B, is we have a plan, we have a flight plan, we have a, you know, an exam or whatever. You figure out the plan to get yourself from here to there. You consult and figure out all the sources of info. And as you mentioned, for the like the adventure flying, there's very little career guidance and knowledge in the system to help navigate that. So it was,
I think, mainly because it's a life choice, right?
Yeah.
Like there's guys that either say, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life.
It's not a career. It's not a stepping stone. It's a destination.
Right.
And so in my case, it was just develop a plan and figure out the steps to get from here to there and go qualify yourself. And then
how was it the first time you get to Alaska, and then this is going to be like your first flight, right? Your first flight, you get to Alaska. How you're jumping in the plane? Where were you going from? Where to where? What was it?
As a commercial operator or just flying along?
Just flying. Let's say flying alone. Right?
Flying along. So I was a tourist. I looked at some of the adventure excursions that you can find in and around Anchorage and Denali and Talkeetna area. I said that looks pretty cool. Let's go land on a glacier with K2 Aviation. Because I was a licensed pilot at the time, I financed dangled my way to sit in front of the turbine otter. And so we had intercom headsets, of course. And I connected with the pilot and started asking him and quizzing him about his career. And I straight up said, how did you get to do this? How do you get to do this? Because I knew in the back of my mind, I really wanted your seat. I wanted to be in a seat like yours. And he said, well, this is what I did. I had to build the experience. I needed to become eligible to operate in this environment. And this is unlike most of the other environments, so it's fairly well baked and you qualify by these criteria. Alaska, for example, is very strict on, of course, the safety and the experience of pilots, and almost to the point that it's unachievable because, for example,
that kind of thing. How do you get there?
Yeah, to fly in Alaska commercially, you have to have demonstrated Alaska flying experience. Well, how do you get to do that? You have to go buy your flying time. So I had to go up to Alaska, rent, fly with friends, accrue Alaska time so that I can demonstrate
that you can fly
that I actually had experience, and then combined with like the float time and all of that.
You had a little bit of that experience, right? How did you manage that?
I actually connected with an older bush pilot on Facebook. I think I wrote him a message, and I was in a Stoll. I was in a group, an Alaska bush pilots group, and I was going up to Alaska on a fishing trip, and I wrote in the group like, hey, I'm a pilot. Is anybody willing to take me up? And a couple guys gave me offers, actually, and I took this one guy up on it, and he took me out flying out there, and it was pretty great. And I actually, the same kind of thing. I finagled my way up into the right seat of an otter and flew around and did some landings.
I think these guys must get requests like on a daily basis, right?
Of course.
Because there's just so many of us that have that vision of just, you see yourself adventure flying, the mountains, the glaciers, the blue sky, the snow. It's just so pretty that they must be constantly getting asked the same question of, how can I do this kind of flying? Now, you and I share the Bahamas flying, which to me, that was one of the best times of my life. You know, flying a 402 in the Bahamas. Myself. Now, you guys are doing it a little bit better. You were able to land on the water. I couldn't land on the water. Mm-hmm. How was that experience flying seaplanes in the Bahamas?
It was fantastic. The Caribbean, not the Caribbean, but the tropical ocean, tropical islands flying floats is like landing on a swimming pool. You know, you pick the leeward side, pick the calm water side, all the ocean is pretty much usable. So it's relatively easy in the world of float flying compared to some of the other tougher water and climatic.
There's
conditions.
Nothing to hit on the boat.
Nothing much to hit.
Maybe your boat.
Sandbar, yeah, maybe the beach. My voice is giving it. But it was great. The weather isn't really too challenging. I mean, there are times of the year that it's convective, a lot of convective stuff. So of course, with avionics, with the equipment in the caravan, with little weather radar, you could navigate your way around. And from a safety perspective, over the water, over the open ocean water is not safe really, unless it's protected water, because you'd be in just as much hurt trying to go down on open ocean, even if it looks pretty calm from 500 or 1,000 feet up. It's not. And you might be very lucky if you stay upright, putting any airplane, floats or not, down on open ocean water. So it is risky as well as from a weather and climatic perspective. But when, you know, in the commercial flying there, of course, we try and be safe and try and maintain altitudes within gliding distance of relatively safe water. So we wouldn't just go tool around 500 feet over open ocean. That's just a little silly. But the flying is great. The weather is great. The sandals and beach wear kind of flying. And
yeah, you get to hop in shorts
and hop in the swimming pool while you're waiting on passengers kind of thing.
You had an excuse to get wet. I have to push the seaplane out.
Yeah. Layovers become a whole lot easier when you're in the water already.
Out of all the islands in the Bahamas, which one would you say is your favorite?
I would say down the Exuma chain is, from a scenery perspective, that's the prettiest. There's a bunch of islands down there.
Yeah, you have that deep water on one side and very shallow water.
Very, very shallow. It's so pretty. Just visually dramatically beautiful, whether you're up 1,000 feet or on the water. So, I mean, the amount of blue. I always tell friends when I want to describe how the scope of the shallow water area in the Bahamas versus other places on Earth. If you take a Google satellite view and you zoom out to an appropriate level, and then you take the Bahamas and the scale of what it represents on your screen and look anywhere else on the globe, there's nothing like it. South Pacific has a little bit. Indian Ocean, the Seychelles has some of it, the Barrier Reef. But the size of the shallow water in the Bahamas is unique in the world.
That color on the map, I mean, I've done the same exercise with my friend. If you look at the map of the world, and that color water only happens in very small places. And we're so lucky to have this, like, literally in our back.
Within 40 minutes off of Florida, you have more than that.
You can go to 150 and it's in 40 minutes.
Yes.
It's so close, and we're so lucky to have that. And, you know, you asked me on this trip, I said, what's your favorite place to overnight? And my answer was, guess, Miami, right? Like, it's just so beautiful. And you asked me, what was the next place? What was the question? Well, where would you live if you couldn't live in Miami? I said, Fort Lauderdale.
Mm.
And if you can't live in Fort Lauderdale, West Palm Beach. You know, I'm like, do I get my point across? It's just, for me, you know, and it happens every time I do the approach into Miami.
Yeah.
And I just see this blue ocean with the green and the palm trees. It's just so calming and so I'm home. Like, I just, it's so hard to run away from it. I like running away, but I just love coming back to that.
From a piloting perspective and being over the water and going to water landing destinations, it's a very calming and relaxing and a pleasant environment to be operating a piece of aviation machinery. It's visually very pleasing and satisfying to do that.
Yeah, I love flying the seaplane around that area. It's just so beautiful. I mean, yes, you can have amazing lakes all over the country, but it's just nothing beats flying into salt water. And I haven't had the opportunity that you've had to take a seaplane out to the Bahamas. I can't imagine, like, just being able to say, hey, I want to check this beach out. And, I mean, nobody goes out. So, absolutely, as a commercial operator, you obviously can't land anywhere. But as far as general aviation, are you familiar? Like, when you land in the Bahamas and you do, like, a cruising permit, do they have any restrictions of landing the seaplane anywhere in the country? Or is it restricted to airports? How did you guys navigate that? Or how would a GA pilot navigate that? Are you familiar with that by any chance?
No, I wouldn't say that I'm up to speed. I know that it's VFR flight plans only, daytime. Obviously, daytime operation only. Very strict sunset to sunlight.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, you could be lined up even for commercial operation. You are not taking off before sunrise.
Right.
The days that we would overnight in Nassau, let's say, or a runway, you would not be allowed to be even close to the active runway environment before the actual sunlight.
Which was a great thing because you knew that you were the earliest departure you're going to have was 9 a.m. because that's when custom opened. You're going to pay overtime and you'll be done by 5 o'clock because that's when custom. So really, it was a 9-to-5 job, and then you literally get to go to the places and the bars. I mean, I was 18 when I was doing this. So I could have a drink in the Bahamas, but I couldn't have a drink back at home. So it was.
Yeah, as for places where you can actually land, let's say you go fly your GA float plane, I don't know if the rules have changed. I would say the best is to consult with the Bahamian, you know, aviation authorities just to make sure you do the right thing. You love, of course, in and out of the country for US-based, US-based, you know, border crossing, all the standard rules apply. EAPIS, electronic, it's made very easy. So ports of entry and do the custom stuff. That's relatively easy. Travel, legal travel permits, of course, mandatory. So if you check all those boxes, like, can you go do cowboy kind of stuff? No, not really. But you have a fair amount of freedom.
Right. A lot more than you probably have in a regular airplane.
Yeah.
I always see these amazing photos on Instagram, and you're always living all these crazy adventures. How do you manage to capture these shots? I mean, I have a hard time being able to capture stuff that I'm doing. So how do you involve the camera? How do you bring that into what you do on an everyday basis?
So from a filming perspective, I do one of two things. I either at the controls and flying, or I'm not flying and then I have time to do camera stuff. Sometimes I've done external mount stuff where you can obviously capture stuff like that while you're actually operating at the controls on the inside. But it's either or. You don't try and fly and still point a camera out the window. It's just
not good practice.
Yeah, it's just,
well, we see that's gotten a few pilots in trouble.
Common sense. So I separate those two roles. And then how do I get to I think the second part of the question is, how do I get to these places? Well, I love to travel. And I'm very intentional with the travel that I do around the world to try and always include and involve aviation in the places where I end up. So, for example, I'd go to Scandinavia and find some aviation friends to take me to the seaplane base to go check out the seaplanes in Oslo. For example, so when you see photos like that, I happen to be traveling there for some reason, for personal reasons, and then I go seek out aviation. And when a bunch of aviation friends get together, they might want to go fly. You might end up being lucky enough to do air-to-air, to have an air-to-air opportunity. Sometimes we're in a location, there's beautiful terrain, and we all sit around the table like this, and we agree, like, let's go try and do an air-to-air wouldn't it be cool to get some aerial shots of airplanes with a nice backdrop?
Of course.
Of course.
And what pilot is going to say no to going up in the air and taking some
risks? Well, so the next step of that is, if you look at any of my air-to-air stuff, the results of that, just know that it's a very elaborate, expensive, time-consuming, very intentional exercise. It's not just somebody's go fly and the one person points a camera out the window. You can do it that way, but the stuff I do is very intentional. And then when I'll wear the hat of the photographer, we spend, like as with any of these things, we spend probably 80% on the ground planning, the ground briefing, the safety briefing, the pre-flight briefing, not even close to the equipment, just talking about the mission, how we're executing, the exit plans, the failure scenarios, like the EPs. Because now you have potentially a formation, a loose formation. If it's two aircraft, you have at least that. If you're trying to form two airplanes in formation, now you have a third. You're interfering with flight safety no matter which way you look at it. So the safety briefing, the protocol, the figuring out if the pilots are comfortable, let alone can it be done on paper, are these operators capable? Have they demonstrated experience in doing that kind of thing? Because it's one thing to sit around and say, oh, that'd be nice, let's go fly over a glacier and have a formation of two seaplanes. Well, yeah, that would be cool. But then the next step of qualifying and understanding that, what would the eligibility, there's no right or wrong. I mean, there's the common sense thing. So I think based on a little bit of the experience that I've had acquired doing it, I will guide in the pre-flight planning. I'll set the direction for the safety piece of the safety part of what we're about to do.
You have the both point of views. I think it's funny because Trent Palmer just released a video with a watch that he was filming a commercial for, and he was actually part of it, of the commercial. Mm-hmm. But he's also has been on the other side of directing it and kind of not directing, but actually like shooting it. And these guys are basically like, yeah, just give me what you can, because he can see what they would, you know, the picture of what it would look nice on camera and also be able to fly it. And it's, I guess it's kind of hard when you're a pilot to just sit there and you have that also the vision of what it would look nice for a camera to sit there and kind of take direction and just give them what they want. So
when you're dealing with a very dynamic situation like airplanes moving around in three-dimensional space, of course, when you're thinking of the visual end result, you have to consider not only the framing, which you could argue is relatively easy, but the lighting conditions changes second to second as you're moving through the sky. So figuring out your maneuvering, your flight path and your maneuvering plan and plan B and plan C is very critical so that you don't go fly. It's like almost like the equivalent of flight training. You don't take a student up and figure out what the teaching is going to be in the air. It's the most expensive and most risky. So everything is pretty choreographed. It's pre-planned on the ground. We never, in the stuff that I do, we never change the plan mid-flight. We might change it because weather is rolling in or we have to, you know, cancel the plan. But we never improvise and say, oh, let's just go do that now. Because
I love that level of detailness and like professionalism towards these approaches. Because a lot of times like I'd be very stressed going up and just saying, okay, let's just go and shoot. Versus where you have a plan and you actually, you know, execute the fact. We've been talking about doing that, you know, for the school. And I'm like, yeah, I can't do it by myself. It's just one person. Like, it'd be nice to have somebody that actually like knows how to not only man the camera, but understands how airplanes work and knows what to demand and what to ask for, because it's very different. Like,
well, yeah, I would say the short of it is it's very scripted and it tries to account for all the known possible emergency scenarios. And so in the mindset of how do we execute EPs, just take formation. If it's two pilots that are comfortable with formation flying, well, they should be versed and skilled and proficient in executing EPs in a formation. Well, now you got a third plane. Are we in the way? Where should we be not to be in the way? And let's never violate that. And so when planning that, you also have to have the pilots participating, actively participate and drive input into the equation. So for the most part, we try and keep photo plane and formation separated in all the phases of flight so that we're not separated by distances for the photographic, because that's so, it's not even secondary. It's so way down on the list. The primary concern is to go have fun, fly, and be safe and come back. And if we're really lucky, we might end up with a photo or a video clip that's nice to watch, but that's really not the primary intent.
Was photography a hobby that you always had, or was it influenced by aviation that you wanted to document aviation, so then you just picked up this hobby? Or
it was always an interest from a very young age that I can remember. I would, before I owned a camera, I used to sketch, pencil sketches and stuff of nature and birds and trees and mountains and landscapes and stuff like that. I had an inclination of expressing visually things that I observe. Once I got in an airplane and got to treetop and felt like a bird, all of a sudden I had three dimensions to work in. And I think that was a catalyst to me trying to use photography equipment to try and capture that emotion of what it feels like to be up in the air like a bird. And that it just evolved into trying to finesse and mature the skills in capturing the emotion again. The visual piece is one. Yeah, there's some guidelines as to how to construct a visual representation of real life. But the reason why you want to do it is to express an emotion, to connect with the audience and show some kind of a emotion. And so it's very hard to do that if things move around all the time. If you're up in the air and you're just looking down. So you can imagine it's a very dynamic environment. So it's always a challenge to try and capture it in a way that it tells a story and it evokes some emotion on the viewer's side.
You have taught several classes before on aviation photography at EAA as well. And yeah. Sun & Fun as well?
No, I never did any workshops at Sun, but mostly Oshkosh and some of the other local events. Yeah.
Will we see you at Oshkosh? Would you be...
This year in 24, yes.
Is there going to be some class? Do you know them yet? Or
It's a volunteer system. You know, most of the Oshkosh participation, at least for the workshops and the class and the home builders and the construction stuff, and also the workshops on any and all other aviation topics, it's all volunteer based. So I do it just because I think there might be value in in sharing some of the excitement of capturing aviation in all its forms, whether it's ground to ground or ground to air, or, you know. And it's exciting and it's also energizing to see the energy of the people in the room and get the questions and to help people maybe figure out a hurdle that they need to overcome with their camera equipment, because we all want to present or capture something different. That's the beauty of photography, is you and I can be at the flight line looking at the same T6 landing. We see different pictures, right?
Absolutely.
So when you get an audience of a selection of people, it's very interesting to interact, and it's fun to interact and share and try and help them figure out some of the hurdles. So most of the stuff that I do is not really a lecture. It's more of a Q&A session. It's like a workshop. I try and be very engaging and ask the question, bring questions, and then we'll talk about it and let's see how the rest of the... And sometimes the class will even, or the audience will answer the question.
Their own questions.
Yeah. So I do that. I try and do that every year, this year as well.
When we were talking earlier, it almost seems like you have some type of project in there that you want to document, something more like a documentary thing of aviators or their stories, and bring those out. Like, is there a plan that you have for that? Like, do you have some type of secret vault with all this data or videos that you're going to eventually come out with something, some type of documentary? Is that something on the plan?
The short answer, yes. The use of social media in the way we operate it today and consume it today, to me, when I started using these platforms, was just to find a convenient way of sharing my work online with the intent of reaching an audience and trying to excite and inspire perhaps the next generation, or not demographically the next, but the person that would want to get involved in aviation, whatever form. If I could do something with my visual products to inspire them to take the next step or to take action, that was my ultimate goal. And it still remains today my ultimate goal. If I can inspire one person to take the step towards whatever they decide is their goal or next step, then I've accomplished that. And so adopting the social media platforms is obviously a way of mass distribution and potentially reaching an audience. And I think it's been rewarding in many ways. In when I see the feedback, I see the comments, people write me. And just out of nowhere, unsolicited, I get comments and feedback about the response that people have to some of the work that I put out. And it's the more meaningful ones are when people just volunteer, hey, I've been looking at your stuff. And let's say the backcountry flow, the off-airport stuff has been very inspiring. And I've decided, because of what I've seen you do, I've decided to take the next step. And my next step in, let's say this case, was to go to a flight school and take an intro flight. And if my image or a set of images was the only thing that got that person to take that next step, that's battle won. Because I know that now we've gained one more enthusiast, one more participant in aviation that I think is such a rich, diverse lifestyle. Any person can choose any lifestyle within and make it so within aviation industry, in my opinion.
I agree.
It's not true for other industries. Like, you can try and become a Mount Everest explorer and be in finance. Well, yeah, maybe, because you make a lot of money and then you spend whatever. Aviation as an occupation, you can carve out a lifestyle of choice and make it happen within aviation.
I can relate to that feeling. I mean, you're an example. Having a flight school, obviously, and seeing, my last trip was with an instructor that, came as a student, became an instructor, and, got his time, became an airline pilot, and got to be my co-pilot. The odds that the next trip I'm flying with you that also went through.
Wow.
And just seeing people grow and I remember watching him doing the walk around. It was like so emotional. Like, man, like, this is so cool. And we're changing people's lives, right? Like, they went from, not knowing what they were going to do, or knowing what they were going to do, but they didn't know how to get there, to actually making it happen. It's a very rewarding aspect. So you get to push them into the industry. I get to see them go through the industry and then come out.
You have a very, very hands-on, example. Mine is pretty hands-off, and it's kind of into the ether, and anonymously people might see it. They might not. You never know who's watching. And it's very rewarding in both cases. Like, Tristan, what made you get into aviation? Like, why are you even doing that?
When I was a child, my mom used to take me to the airport. We just watch planes. And something, after college, I worked in a lab for a couple of years. And then she was like, we always wanted to be a pilot. Why don't you go do that? And I was like, why don't I go do that?
Yeah.
And when did it not?
Yeah, it's amazing to hear those stories where people will change careers from one day to the other. It's like, I'm stuck a day in an office and I've always wanted to do this. They go in and they change careers and they make, they make success out of it. And I love hearing those stories, and I love seeing those stories. I mean, I see those stories on a daily basis. And it's very rewarding. So I can definitely see where you're coming from when you see. And you say that you're a very hands-off approach, but I think you have a very broad reach, unlike us. Yeah, we're a local community, right? We're a local small flight school, but you get to influence people around the world, right? So,
well, it's just because the more time you spend, you're bound to accrue, some kind of a audience. And it's really not about that. The size of either audience or the amount of people in the room really is irrelevant. It's about reaching the one person. And if the means to get to that person is via a local newspaper, a social media platform, it doesn't really matter. I think that the key of it is if the message reaches the person and in the format that can help them take the next step. We all have goals and idealisms, and many of us, and I think we can all relate, some point in time you're stuck trying to make a decision using perfect good data set, making the right data-driven decision. But there's just one piece of information or guidance or mentorship that's missing. And if my piece of little information blob that I send out there could be the piece, then I'm perfectly happy. It's very inspiring for me to get that feedback. So yes, of course, I enjoy practicing the craft of creating visual images of stuff that I feel excited about, but it's the human element. Ultimately, if you see humans respond to that in a positive way, that's first prize.
Yeah, we were just talking about the human connection too at Oshkosh, right? Like, that's what makes that event so special. We have a bunch of airplanes around, but really it's our one time of the year where everybody is concentrating. We get to see all our aviation buddies and spend time together, and that's what makes it like so special. It's that human aspect of it.
There's one theme of aviation and the aviation industry, and you could express it in many different ways. we hear things like, you don't get a job in aviation unless you have a job in aviation. It's like almost this chicken and egg thing. But the one theme that's really universally true is, was for me, and what I see in people that I connect with, total strangers. And it's that people that have the patience and persist in pursuing their dreams, no matter what it is, whether it's aviation or not, ultimately hard work and commitment pays off. And in aviation, it translates for the most part to show the commitment, be there, show up, be present, just show up. The people new to aviation, they just show up at the airport. They go there every day. They are just so enthusiastic. They are there. There's nothing else that they want to do. And even if they sit around and fuel or at the FBO or at the parking lot, or ultimately their energy and their commitment will translate into demonstrating their energy and their creativity, and it'll be rewarded.
Plus you always learn, right? Even just by sitting and talking about aviation. I mean, I think we learn a lot just from hearing other people's stories and their experiences. And those stories will stick with you, and they will come back when you're flying the airplane. And they're, wait a minute, maybe I shouldn't do this, or maybe I should do this way. So I think there's a lot of value to just going to the airport or sitting around and talking about aviation.
There's of course the community and how we interact, you know, hangar talk and all of that. There's also the other universal truth, I think, that is one of the things, one of the guiding principles that goes something like this, like always be the dumbest person in the room. And if you find yourself, you know, in a group of people and you think, well, been there, done that, well, maybe it's time for you to move on and go find that room where you are absolutely the dumbest person in the room, because that's where you'll learn and find the most knowledge and get knowledge to consume quickest.
In Spanish, we have a saying, is like, tell me who you're with and I'll tell you who you are. Mm-hmm. And that's basically the same aspect, right? Like if you're around aviators, you'll be an aviator. You know, if you're around something else, then you're not going to be an aviator. I think that's really important too, because you always learn from absorption of just what people are talking about.
Yeah. There's one thing about the learning aviation thing, and I think we all have examples of how that manifests. I remember my initial check ride. Done. Thank you very much. Congratulations. And my examiner ended by saying, now remember, now you have a license to learn. And we all know that. But he said two things. He says, go have fun in doing this thing. And always remember to, if you have not learned, then you're doing something wrong. Go figure out a way to, after every flight, every interaction with aviation,
learn.
There is so much. And it couldn't be, you know, better said, because aviation is such a dynamic world environment. There is never not a time that you cannot learn stuff. Or did I say too many nevers in there?
No,
but you can always learn in aviation, no matter where you are.
This is not an industry where you come in, you take the license, and then that's it.
Yeah.
You just keep doing the same thing forever.
Yeah.
It's always changing. We always have new technologies. I mean, we see it at work, right? They're always changing our manuals.
Yeah, so, and it should be a humbling place to be, you know, keep yourself grounded. It's not as if we're lecturing to people, but make sure that you're in it for the right reason. And back to the be curious, like there's so much going on. And back to the Oshkosh, a lot of the interesting people in the community there is about inspiring the next generation and, you know, sharing knowledge and sharing the excitement of having something to do in aviation, even if you're not flying, if you're just at an airport or at an aviation function. I think events like Oshkosh, you know, is a very good place to demonstrate this combined effect of the community and the power that you can get from share like-minded people.
Yeah, a lot of love there. I really like the energy at Oshkosh.
Yeah, yep, yep.
I know going back, we were talking technology, and I think we had a good conversation about the Apple Vision Pro, about the augmented reality and virtual reality, but we kind of went away from that topic. And we were talking about, like, for example, today, you know, we were coming in and we got traffic advisory, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're like, where is it? We're looking outside of the airplane. You know, how cool would it be to have like something that would target and say,
yeah, yeah,
look here, this is where the airplane is.
Yep.
But a lot of the stuff that I saw on the comments were like negative stuff, like pushing this technology back. And you kind of had the same experience like that in your IT world, where you see regulations push back and really hold back the progress of new technologies into this field. What do you feel about that technology coming into our cockpits? I mean, we kind of already have something like that with heads-up displays, but what about if we actually have something that we can see and, you know, have a little bit more use for pilots and just overlaying the instruments on, you know, in the front?
Well, so I shared with you the story when I did my master, my computer science and postgrad research work. It was just at the time when computer graphics technology hardware became capable enough that you can render in 3D pretty sophisticated images. And my thoughts immediately went to, how can we apply this? And aviation was one of the things. You know, we deal with the 3D world, and how cool would it be to equip ATC and airborne crews with sufficient tools to make them safer, number one, and maybe help them do a more effective, be more effective in executing the mission. Fast forward that conversation, we said the technology that is proclaimed to be innovative and new today in the cockpit, for example, is archaic from a technology perspective. It might be new to aviation, but there's no rocket science in 2D displays and rendering 3D data mapped onto a 2D plane. It's the same consumption problem that existed 40 years and 50 years ago, different display technologies.
But it's displaying the exact same information.
It's the same data set. It might be augmented or enhanced or enriched with additional dimensions of data. For example, you might see traffic with trend vectors and altitude info and perhaps something else, you know, whatever other parameters. So you can bring in more data, but we haven't really evolved in adapting the display technology to a place where I think humans can interpret it and make safer decisions based on the presentation layer. So will AR play a role? I think so. If you look at in the near future, I think so. If you take the example of heads-up displays, it was kind of an extension of the same technology. Display technology is just presented in a different plane field of view. So fast forward to the viewing devices that are clumsy and clunky and totally ridiculous right now. Nobody's going to be strapping on a swimming glasses to operate in a very dynamic world. But the concept is, can you present the data in a more consumable manner for the person operating the machine? I think yes. And whether the viewing technology obviously won't be this kind of confined.
And then we're talking about the iPhone version 1, right? This is the first iPhone that came out.
Version 0 in beta.
In beta. This is nothing like, this is just the beginning of this stuff. I mean,
the thing about 3D space and interpreting and disseminating useful information and rendering and presenting it in a 3D version versus 2D, I think for us humans makes it more intuitive and perhaps more safe to consume because you can adjust the angle of view and you can interrogate and spin the cube around.
Have you tried this though? And tried the Apple Vision Pro?
No.
I wish I'd bought them on this trip, but I mean, a week after somebody sent me, like, here's the application that you're talking about already. Mm-hmm. And literally, I opened the application in my room on my overnight, and I laid out a turbine in the middle of the room, and I literally can click next.
Right. So imagine if you're like an air traffic controller and you have all these air at a local tower, right? Mm-hmm. You know, now they look at a screen and it's just a blip, right? And they have to have the memory or the little slots that they have. It's like, okay, I have this airplane and this is the next one, and I'm going to clear this one to land and move it over. Now they can just see it in 3D and be able to, like, maybe select it, click it. Okay, the green one, I gave them a landing clearance. The one that's blue, I haven't given a landing clearance. And I can see the tail number, November 9012 Azuno, clear to land. Bloop. Now I have an indication that I give this guy a clearance. I think there's so many possibilities that if we're willing to accept it and push forward, that we'll benefit from.
The display tech we have today is near archaic still. 2D displays have been around for ages. Heads-up displays that we have today is still 2D rendering or a 2D mapping. But imagine you can render that data at certain times in three dimensions because we get such a more rich experience and much more efficient in ingestion of the data because we see three dimensions. Why would we take 3D space, map it to 2D, show it to our brains in 2D, and then we have to reconstruct it in 3D. I mean, it's so many extra cycles that go into doing that.
So we got a lot of feedback from that video too, where people were like, how did you get an application out so quickly?
Of course.
And I'm like, well, it's not an application. It's just something that we created. But I think the biggest value too for these headsets, and I think we'll see this early, right? Because it's going to be a while before these headsets are going to be in the cockpit. I know.
Of course. Or never.
Or never. Yeah. Because we're very slow at the way that we do stuff. But can you imagine your student, right? He's going to go on his first solo cross country, but now you can actually like brief on for flight where you can actually see the entire flight. But you can now sit in the office and look outside your 152 or 172 and look at your checkpoints and see what they look like when you're at 4,000 feet or when you're at 5,000 feet.
Here's the analogy. In problem areas where humans do execute very sophisticated missions, and they do that with a set of skills that are very hard to come by. For example, the medical field. For those surgeons to operate the new robotic-assisted machinery, they rehearse, they practice, they simulate those procedures in an environment that closely approximates the real thing. So the analogy is pilots do the same thing, but your example, oh, by the way, we can never simulate the real first-person view, for example, visualization of what your cross-country might look like. Well, why not? Well, the tech is hard to come by. And, oh, by the way, you can do it on the ground, but there's none of that in the cockpit because of regulatory and safety and compliance. And we know the part of the equation that governs that, it's all for the right reason that we want to go slow and not introduce potential risk elements. That's all that it's about. So it really is about safety. And so you don't want to introduce risk elements that will impact the safety equation. But can it move faster? I think it can. And can you take baby steps? I think you can.
Coming back to what you said, and I wanted to bring this point out earlier too, but when we get in a position like where you know, the position that you are yourself, or myself, right, where you're already an airline pilot, you're established, people that are coming into the industry, what you say, they take seriously. And it's even sometimes when you make stuff as a joke, you know, they might not come across as a joke for other people, and they might understand, like, so it, what I'm trying to get to, like, some of the stuff that I was reading on that, in the comments that people were making, it would make me feel like somebody that doesn't know or understand the industry will come in and look at that stuff and be like, I don't want this. This is a horrible idea. And they're pushing away a technology that can be so useful for them. Just, you know, and again, I was clicking the profiles of the people saying that, and there were 747 captains at Atlas. There were, you know, Airbus pilots. There were people that were, you know, in flight instructors. You are a mentor. You are the people that people look up to and ask questions. And so when you have these roles of credibility, what you say really has an influence of people that on the people that are entering the industry. So I guess the biggest thing to say is, like, just be careful what you say, because people are listening, and when you're at this position, like, they will take you serious.
It's very true. So there's a few things in what you just said. Perception is a reality. So on the receiving side, if I perceive your interaction with me as something, no matter what your intent was, it's the way that I perceive it and receive it. That is my reality. So the metaphor in terms of describing the social media is, in an audience that perceives your statement or your piece of knowledge that you share, they perceive it in a certain way and they have an opinion. Like, everybody has an opinion, as we know. And the internet seems to, you know, demonstrate the fact that people can have anonymous opinions and even have opinions beyond what they think is reasonable. That aside, I think if you look at a standard distribution across a population of opinions, you're going to get everything. I think we should be responsible in the way we pursue the development of technology and applying technology in any industry, whether it's the medical sciences, where life and death is the mission, aviation, where safety is the mission. To not participate and not be curious and not want to demonstrate the use of technology in a positive way, I think that's irresponsible too. So as technology enthusiasts and people constantly seeking perhaps an opportunity to make things safer and better and more efficient by the use of technology, we should absolutely promote that in a responsible way. You could take the example of space travel today and the way that it's accelerating, because you've created an avenue for private enterprise to experiment in a relatively safe way that official or government forces could not and still cannot. And so
you have seen how successful that has been.
Well, we're seeing a rapidly accelerating part of space travel that has been enabled by allowing them to operate in a mode and in an area which limits the potential risk to human life and property. And the same with aviation. To entertain the idea that this tech might eventually be useful, I think that's wise. And I think presenting it in a responsible way, yes. We have a responsibility when we're up on a public stage, when we voice an opinion or just state a fact. It can always be interpreted in
many different ways.
However many ways exist, you will get back to the standard distribution. The audience will give you that. So let's not get discouraged by the response, whether it's a complete response or a fraction of the response or the initial response. I think the conversation should be, technology and the evolution of technology is here to stay with humankind, and we should always be excited about challenging ourselves and our belief systems and our ways of practicing stuff safely. Can technology be introduced to help? I think it can. But yeah, of course we need to be smart about it. We're not going to the clinical trials are not conducted in an unsafe manner, and neither should we do clinical trials in aviation. Yeah, it's just not wise. We're not promoting that, of course.
Deanne, it's been a pleasure having you. We've had many good conversations. We have never recorded them.
Yeah, we're trying to record one.
We're trying to record one. I mean,
at 5 a.m. my time.
Yeah. But I mean, we're literally like 5 hours before the time. I'm like, wait a minute, let's go grab the camera because we're never going to shoot this. But honestly, it's been a pleasure having you. I hope to have you back in a more controlled environment. Tristan, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Yeah.
Deanne is a very interesting character, and I'm really happy to have this conversation with you because there's always something to learn. So thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to see you here soon.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. And I think to anybody listening, tuning in, make the time and spend the effort to connect with individuals and people that that create value in your friend's circle. And our friendship has definitely been valuable to me as well. So thank you very much for reciprocating, creating the opportunity. We're at Newark Airport. We all just flew in today or yesterday. I spent 15 hours getting here. You spent 4 hours, or what was it, 3 hours from
Orlando? We started early. We started at 4 a.m. this morning.
But just the make it happen, take the time and spend time with people. I think that's most important.
It's time that I'm willing to sacrifice sleep for, because it's experiences that really pay off.
Thank you very, very much for making it happen. Tristan, thank you. Tristan, thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us.
We hope you've enjoyed the show. For more of our content, search on YouTube for Aviator Zone. If you know someone we should have on the show, please reach out at podcast@aviator.zone.